Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet and Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce. Tim, Shell Oil's drilling program in the Arctic is on again, off again. Yet an ADN headline said Shell poised at promising burger site. Please clarify and get us up to date on what's going on with Shell.
Well, right now, Michael, Shell is poised, but they're 30 miles south waiting for this massive ice flow to pass over the burger site. This is really, it takes the cake. I mean, poor Shell has spent close to $5 billion on this project, has yet to really sink a well. So they finally get the drill ship up there. The Chukchi Sea is free of ice, except for this one big ice flow, 11 miles long, or rather 30 miles long by 11 miles wide. And it aims right at Shell's burger drill site. So the drill ship has to pull off just hours, like 12 or 14 hours after they got on location, got anchored up, and got the go-ahead to start operations. They got to de-anchor, pull the ship off, and wait for the ice to pass. And it's moving very slowly.
Now, I assume that this is truly a matter of luck, that this is something you know, they know that there are ice flows, there are ice sheets in that part of the world, but you can't predict it's going to come right at you.
I know, that's the only one out there. Well, they actually have been watching, we're watching this for days, and we're concerned about it, and just what happens is you get the wind picked up behind it, and you can sort of predict that kind of thing, but you, in a way, although this is obviously very disappointing to Shell, another setback, in a way, I mean, there's a good news aspect to it, too, because it shows that they have the capability to respond to these things. I mean, you know, the ice comes, you just pull up and pull back and let it go and then go back in.
Now, if somebody was looking at a map, what would the nearest community to this site be?
Well, this is about 65 miles west of the coast, so it would be about 65 miles west of Barrow, probably. West and a little bit southwest of Barrow, way offshore.
And how many men and women, how many employees, how many personnel would they have working on something like this?
Well, I don't know the number of people, but they have they've mobilized like a whole bunch of ships. Their whole fleet is 20 ships, but that includes the Kulik and other vessels.
This is like the Navy.
Yeah. But at the site, they have the drill ship, the Noble Discoverer. They have an icebreaker, not a big enough one, to, unfortunately. They have a tanker, they have two or three anchor support vessels, they have a spill response vessel. So they've got a small fleet, flotilla, right there at the site. And then they have other vessels. They have another drilling ship or drilling structure in the Beaufort Sea waiting to drill there, too. That's way to the east near Prudhoe Bay.
And what is their window for drilling activity and getting in and getting out?
Well, theoretically, they could drill into October in the Chukchi Sea. The Interior Secretary has given them, however, till September 21 to stop drilling into hydrocarbon-bearing zones. And what that means is they can drill the top part of a well, they can do all the preparations, but they can't actually drill down to where the oil is because they want to allow enough time. If there's an oil spill, they can deal with it before the winter ice comes in.
And one final question, Tim. Through this drilling, what kind of specific information are they looking to obtain to affect their future activities?
Well, what's important, Michael, is that they know oil is there, oil and gas is there at this site, because they drilled this in the early 1990s. Shell used to have this lease. They found gas, quite a large gas resource, some oil. It wasn't economic, so they actually, ironically, they gave the lease up and gave it back to the government and then had to reacquire it in 2008. What they're looking for is how much oil and gas is there. They think there's a lot more because they have new seismic techniques that enable them to see more than they could see before. So they think it's quite promising, but they don't know until they drill. So they know there's something down there. They've got some well information from the previous drilling, but they need to get back in there and drill down.
And quite obviously, they thought continuing onward with this was well worth it based on what they knew earlier.
Yeah, obviously, after $5 billion.
Okay. Paul, what are you hearing from the oil patch?
Well, after $5 billion in 6 years, you'd think they'd be a little distraught, but they're not. Everything I've heard is they're very, very excited. They finally are getting to be where they want to be. They've had to cut back their drilling schedule from five wells to two But they've got a 10-year plan, and they're going to, or 5 and 10-year plans, and they're going to stick with those. And I there's a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of optimism, despite the delays with the permits and the construction of their barge and the sea ice. So I think they've got so much time and so much money invested in this, they can see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Okay. This week, the big news story in South Central Alaska was undoubtedly the big windstorm, which affect each and every one of us, unless the few of you who might have been out of town during the week. Tim, where do we even start with this? Maybe the place to start is some kind of evaluation of how the power companies did in getting people's power back on.
Well, it went on for several days. I mean, anybody watching this and listening to this is probably going to have firsthand experience with this thing, but some of us were lucky and had power out. Some had no power go out at all. Some had power go out just overnight. Some were days. And at my house, it was 2 days, 2.5 days. A lot of other people, Paul, you said this morning you heard that just a couple of days ago people
Well, I think a couple of days ago they finally, they still had people that didn't have electricity.
Yeah. I think obviously this just overwhelmed the, you know, the utility companies, the size of this thing. Ironically, the Chugach electric people told me that one of their, they ran out of chainsaws. I mean, they had to fly chainsaws in from Fairbanks. Also, they had obviously scrambled every electrical contractor in town who's available was working on this. There were companies in Fairbanks that sent crews down. So this was a big deal for them. Hopefully with the winds coming up again, I hope they have more chainsaws now, but maybe all the trees that were gonna go down went down.
Let us pray.
Now, Tim, one thing that I think really upset the public is many people felt that they should be able to call up the power companies and get a reasonable expectation of what the circumstances were and when their power was coming back on, and they didn't get much of that, at least particularly from Chugach, which seemed to take the brunt of the criticism. What sort of fair criticism here?
Well, I think probably MLNP was criticized too, but they're smaller than Chugach. Yeah. When I called Chugach, I just got a busy line. And I think, Paul, you said when you called MLNP, the phone rang and rang. And when I also tried to bring up Chugach's website, it was inoperable. And I think that was because it was probably just overwhelmed. The next day, when things slowed down a little bit, I saw the website and it had a nice map with little red dots where the power outage were. So that was some information, but it didn't tell you what you really want to know, is where are they and getting your power back on.
Oh, wow.
You would think that in this day of information technology that there would be ways to deal with this sort of thing. So I think one of the lessons learned out of this exercise maybe has been that the utilities should find ways to get information and be able to get information out more quickly to the public and accurate information. But probably in this situation, they were just so overwhelmed.
This was a huge storm.
Yeah.
It was a huge storm.
Go ahead, Paul.
It was a huge storm. I mean, near hurricane strength in a lot of areas. In a lot of areas, it was hurricane strength.
Yeah.
And I think the damage we came through, it was still leaves on the trees. We had the trees were getting knocked down left and right. A lot of rain. There's going to be many, many problems.
It was a very unusual situation because the leaves on the trees caused it to, usually this happens in the winter when the leaves are gone.
Right.
The roots are frozen. This time the roots were still wet. Mm-hmm. The leaves acted like a big sail, so a lot of trees
took it right
down.
Over.
I heard also this morning that Chugach has said that the storm cost them $2 million, $1.5 million in responding, and then $500,000 in repairs to their equipment.
Wow.
So.
Paul, tell us a little bit about the political response to this. That was sort of surprised. My impression was that the mayor was less active than you might expect.
I guess I was surprised by that too. What a wonderful opportunity to be standing around with, you know, dead trees and angry people and getting your picture out there. But I think most of the anger in this community was directed at the power companies, and I don't think anybody blamed the political structure for any of this. And I think probably a wise politician would say, you know, nobody's shooting at me. I'm not standing up. And I guess where we went here.
And one of the things that struck me is somebody from the Sullivan administration, emergency services, had talked about, what goes on in this kind of situation with this kind of disaster, if you want to use a big word, was is an individual responsibility, and I think some people responded, well, you know, what am I going to do? I can't put the power back on.
That's right.
Well, what can be done, and the governor, Parnell, has been pretty active in this recently, is talking to the public about emergency preparedness and at least make sure you got flashlights. And in our house, we were lucky because we had a wood stove, and when the house started cooling down, we could fire it up. And
you burned down some of the trees that got knocked down.
Yeah, so we were a little bit fortunate, but my wife was a little cranky after the second day, I was awfully glad when the power came on.
And Paul, one of the things that happened here is all the generators in town sold out. The
right.
music of chainsaws we
That's
heard
right.
all over town.
That's right.
And do people actually go out and buy preparedness kits and then to put them away for the next time or
I
not?
I think they do. I mean, I know I looked out and thought, you know what I need to do is I need to replace my chainsaw. So I sometime between now and the near future, I'll get a chainsaw. I think people do. That people want to get out there. They want to be, especially in wintertime. This could have been a real problem in wintertime.
Yeah, this is something
2 days without power is a bad thing.
This is something we ought to talk about because that is the largest danger here. Maybe we ought to be grateful that nobody was killed, but in the wintertime, this would be a very different situation, don't you think, Tim?
Yeah.
And we've had them for short periods in the winter, but nothing like this.
Yeah. I remember the nearest thing in the wintertime that I remember to this was back, gosh, it must have been 20, 25 years ago when an anchor dragged across the inlet and snagged the cable coming from Beluga, and several parts of town were out for an extended period of time. But they can't, they've fixed it now. They can't, that won't happen, but then something else could happen.
Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins and Tim Bradner. Paul, ballot measure one has finally passed. This amends the opportunity of local communities to change their tax forgiveness on senior citizens and others who might be worthy of a tax reduction on their home. Are we liable to see an outbreak of this kind of activity?
Politically, it's just got to be very tempting. Well, look, I got you a $50,000 exemption here. But what the ballot measure did do was simply allow communities to do it, whether they will or not, it's anybody's guess. It passed just by a whisper. I think as people learned what it was about, I think it lost support at the end. What you have is if you have an exemption in property taxes, that's got to be made up someplace. The government has to have that.
Or the government can decide to spend less money.
You're kidding, right? So they've got to make up that someplace. And this was going to seriously affect veterans, the elderly, and businesses. It is a means and a method to shift the tax burden off of property taxpayers and onto other property taxpayers, low-income houses, that sort of rental units, and businesses. So what you're going to wind up paying that, you're going to pay that exemption anyway. It was put together in Fairbanks as a way to help property taxpayers, and I think in the end, I think it's going to hurt property taxpayers. It would be surprising to me legislative body would pass it.
Local governments will have to some degree vet this, and they'll get a fiscal
they'll
note
get a
that
fiscal
tells
note
them
that says, bend over, right?
Or whatever. Okay, use it to pursue a metaphor. Paul, sticking with you, the Matsu Ferry finally has a for sale sign on it. What do you think the people in the Matsu can get for their ferry, which is in dry dock and has never been anyplace else except maybe on tests?
It's an $80 million ferry, twin hull ice breaking capabilities. It's never been in Knik Arm. It's never been anywhere near the Matsu. It's costing them more than $80,000 a month for storage and docking fees and insurance. And I think they just finally put it up for sale. They extended till this past Thursday the time for proposals for people who wanted to dock it and store it. And where that'll go, I don't know. There's a limited market for the vessel, although you would think oil industry, surveying companies, that sort of thing would like it. Shallow draft, very fast. It's got several problems. One, it only holds 20 vehicles. It was intended to carry car traffic between Anchorage and the Matsu Burr, go across right across the mouth there. And there's no facility on either side to take it. That was estimated to be at a $30 million project for both of them. And there probably would be interest in the thing, and it was a military vessel designed to haul tanks, so it could probably haul heavy equipment someplace in shallow draft. But I don't know. I think there's still a segment in the Matsu Borough, legislative and government, that kind of likes the idea of keeping it and having a ferry. But there's going to be a battle royale.
Do you understand who are the financial losers here? I mean, the variety of people who are involved in this financially.
Well, the federal government.
But is there any clear way to apportion that?
Well, TSA gets $13 million right off the top for the money it put in. The Department of Navy has lost a lot of money in this, or put a lot of money into it. A lot of the other money was earmarks to build that boat. I would imagine that the Matsu Borough has lost quite a bit of money in this thing. So, yeah, there are several losers, most of them government, you and me. And from there, it's only going to get worse if they don't find some way to deal with this kind of stacking of bills that keep coming in.
Tim, you have a lot of experience covering Alaska politics and Alaska business. Every once in a while, we have something like this that quickly becomes labeled by the general public that's not involved as a boondoggle. Is that a fair estimate of what happened here, or do you have some special insight based on your experience of what did happen here?
Well, it certainly, as projects go, it certainly would seem to be in the category it would deserve that label. You know, this is going down in the. There have been a number of these kind of projects that have come along where it looks too good to be true. It's something free. I mean, the Matsu Borough leadership at the time felt, you know, the Navy was going to give them a boat, a free boat. And somebody obviously didn't quite think it through that it wasn't, there were strings attached and there were other things that they had to do to really make it work. Or maybe did the fundamental business case, do you have enough car traffic going back and forth to really make this thing work? So yeah, it kind of sounds like something that would be classified a boondoggle. We have a number of other worthy projects up here that are like that. We love the idea of federal money, you know, but we forget what comes.
I think the immortal phrase, "It seemed like a good idea at the time," is coming back to us.
Yeah.
Paul, the Joe Miller lawsuit in Fairbanks against the Fairbanks North Star Borough, which involves the Senate candidate and Republican nominee Joe Miller, and his suit against the Fairbanks North Star Borough, claiming that they had allowed his public records to become, or his personnel records to become public, and they should not have done that, and they deserved to be sued. And he went to court, and the court suit went on for a long, long time.
2 years.
And now Yogi Berra is finally right. It ain't over till it's over, and it's finally over. What can you tell us?
Maybe. Yeah, it's over. The lawsuit was filed in 2010, as you said, because he charged the borough mayor, Fairbanks North Star borough mayor, and the borough itself with releasing portions of his personnel records during the campaign against Lisa Murkowski. I think at first he wanted $160,000, and $50,000, and $25,000, and they settled on $5,000. And then the sticking point became, everybody agreed to the $5,000, and then the sticking point became, well, you're admitting fault. No, we're not. We're not admitting any fault at all. So the judge
if I might, the Fairbanks North Star Borough insisted, or got its way, if you want to look at it that way, in no fault language written into the
agreement. There was no fault language into the judgment that Joe Miller signed. And finally, the judge went, "Hey, you signed this thing. It's done." And that was it. It's over.
Okay, Tim. Miller is frequently named as a potential candidate for various statewide offices. What would you say his prospects are at the present time? This lawsuit probably may not have a big role in them, but just generally speaking.
I would say rather dim, although he's going to have a certain following among the Tea Party crowd. But the fact that he lost after a to Lisa Murkowski, it was an amazing comeback that she organized with a write-in that makes her look very strong. I just don't see a lot of strength there.
You know, what I wondered about is there would be people who invested a lot of money in him, maybe not directly in him, but PACs that spent money, for example, and he couldn't pull it off, and there were people at the time who felt he was, she couldn't get on, or she wasn't on the ballot, she was a write-in.
Yeah.
And sort of all he needed to do was go to the cocktail party, slap everybody on the back, tell them they looked terrific, shake hands, kiss a few babies, and win. But he was so combative, it would seem to me, and in places, I think it's fair to say, peculiar, the arrest of Tony Opfinger being one, that it would seem to me it would raise real questions with people who want to get on board and with money.
Well, you know, people who, you know, the guy comes across as being very volatile and unpredictable. And I think big, you know, the real money in politics hates that sort of thing. You know, the guy could self-destruct. They invest a lot, as he did. And so I think if he runs again, that's going to happen again. It's my prediction.
Paul, you want to add anything?
Well, I think as he goes on and is associated with the Tea Party, and he does things like, you know, publicly fight over $5,000 judgment and who's going to be at fault and who's not. I mean, it only makes him look more peculiar, I think, to the average Alaskan. So I think he's pretty much done himself in for up here.
His ego gets in the way of his judgment, I think. That's the conclusion.
Okay, Tim, Governor Parnell says the state won't cooperate any further on the NPRA development unless the Secretary of the Interior, Kenneth Salazar, implements some of the state's ideas. And once again, he's writing letters and thinking about court activities. What do you make of this?
Well, there's some really harsh words going back and now coming back from Interior. The governor is in some cases kind of rightfully felt wronged by the fact that the Interior Secretary, out of the blue, without informing the state or other agencies that were classed as cooperating agencies under their procedures, giving them any advance warning of the preferred alternative under a number of alternatives that he was going to favor for the NPRA. The NPRA is a big 23 million acre reserve in the Arctic set aside for its oil back in 1923. However, in recent years,
if I might, we should note that it's National Petroleum Reserve Alaska.
That's right.
That's what it's called.
Right. It was originally the Naval Petroleum Reserve Number 4, although no oil or gas, there were indications and small discoveries, but no large discoveries have ever been made. But it's a lot of terrain, a lot of country, and the conservation groups feel very passionately about certain parts of it that are important for bird habitat. So the long and short of it is the Interior Secretary comes out with a plan, a preferred plan, long-range management plan that sets about half of it off limits for drilling, although half of it is still on limits. But the most prospective areas, the state argues, are covered by these closed areas. Anyway, did it without informing the state, and so the governor gets very angry and says, well, under the procedures, the state is a cooperating agency, which really means that they're just at the table in a lot of discussions. It's only a formality. there's no real, the fact that the state withdraws as a cooperating agency doesn't stop the Interior Department from doing something. The lead agency still makes the final decision.
And Tim, for those who see things through a partisan angle, is there any reason that the Parnell administration could assume that if President Romney is president in January, that things might be significantly different, or is this a process that is within the bureaucracy or within unappointed officials?
Oh, undoubtedly there's politics behind it. I mean, everything the federal administration does, the governor will quickly find fault with, whether it's health care or whether it's this or something else, you know, what the EPA does. A lot of times the criticism is deserved, so don't get me wrong, but in this case, the state's withdrawing as a cooperating partner is sort of symbolic. You know, it doesn't really have any procedural, it doesn't have any real impact. But it is kind of a real slap in the face at Salazar, because procedurally, you're supposed to have, you know, when federal agencies do big things, they do big EIS projects and big land planning, you're supposed to have the state involved. And that's what a cooperating agency is. The North Slope Borough is also a cooperating agency. But so to have the state very publicly say, we're not going to talk to you anymore. There may be, I'm sure there's other aspects to it too, like there may be information sharing agreements and things like that between state and federal agencies that this could impede. So I don't know about that.
Paul, what can you add here on this topic?
Well, I know that there's a lot of anger at the state level over this very, very thing, and they're also not very pleased with the idea that the only place where they can bring offshore pipelines ashore, have been closed off unilaterally without discussing that with the state either. So there's there's probably more politics than we even want to admit in this thing. But he's not. He came into office, as Governor Parnell did, vowing to fight the federal government. He's going to sue them at every opportunity and tangle with them whenever they got in the way. And that's what he's doing. I mean, he's carrying
out
what he says.
And from the Obama administration point of view, Ken Salazar from Colorado was picked because he was a Westerner.
The Western guy.
Who had a lot of experience on Western issues and would know how to communicate with Westerners. But that hasn't worked out either.
I think there is a very different mindset when it comes to the Arctic. And it doesn't matter which agency you're with or who you're with or what your political stance is. There are people desperate to save the Arctic and around Lake Tishomook, is that what it is? There are people that are willing to gamble everything to protect those areas.
Well, we can't gamble anymore because we're out of time. Thank you very much for joining us on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.